We looked at sort of an overview of the Song of Solomon. We're going to go back there tonight. If you want to turn over and to the Song of Solomon, we'll get into that in a moment. I mentioned the last time that we talked about it, the church has always been a little weird about the way it deals with the Song of Solomon. I don't mean the modern church, although that's true as well. How many sermons have you heard from it? Probably not many. But the church historically, and even the Jewish people, have always been really weird about the Song of Solomon. Obviously, there's a lot of sexual content in the book of Song of Solomon, or Song of Songs, as it's sometimes called, or Canticles. There's always been, even among Jews, there's been some uncertainty about what to do with it. And most people throughout history have just flat out said it cannot be about what it seems to be about. It just can't. That can't be it. Even though, as you know, maybe the cardinal rule of Bible interpretation is what? Take it at its most obvious meaning. That's the foundational rule of Bible interpretation, just like it is for anything else. Take it at its most obvious meaning. The church has not wanted to do that. And so the church has made it allegorical, sometimes about Christ, the Catholic Church, sometimes about Mary, sometimes about the bride being the church, sometimes about Solomon ruling Israel. There's been all kinds of different interpretations, but most people have been hesitant to just say it's about what it says it's about. But I think that's what it's about. I really do. I just think it's that simple. That the Song of Solomon is a celebration of romantic, marital, and sexual love. That's just what it is. When you read it, that's the plainest understanding that you get from it. And there's no reason that it can't be that. In fact, there's every reason it should be that. Because we know that the home, and specifically within the home, marriage, is the foundation of society. And if marriage and the home get messed up, everything gets messed up. Why wouldn't there be a book? It would be unusual to me if there were not a book that was specifically dedicated to marriage and the home. That would be weird, because it's so important. And that's what Song of Solomon is about. Now, when we say it's a celebration of romantic and marital and sexual love, we don't mean that it's just all like a Hallmark movie and everything's wonderful and there's never a problem. Now, the most well-known verses from Song of Solomon make it appear this way. You know, chapter 1 and verse 2, it starts out, the bride saying, "May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine." Now, it's just, you know, it's just romantic, and it's like greeting cardish, and it's, you know, it's beautiful and wonderful. She says about herself, the bride does in chapter 2 and verse 1, "I am the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valley." She feels wonderfully about herself at this point. She sees herself, because of the way he treats her, she sees herself as this beautiful flower. She feels great about herself. He has brought me to his banquet hall, right? So we're going to go. He's made me this amazing meal. He's got this great spread in front of me, and he hung a big banner proclaiming his love. There's a big sign that he hung up, and it talks about how much he loves me. Or what he says to her in chapter 4. "You are altogether beautiful, my darling. There is no blemish in you." But you know as well as I do that those sentiments are not the sum total of marriage. It is not every single day that a bride is saying, "I sure wish he'd give me a big old kiss." And sometimes the bride is saying, "If he even looks at me, I'm going to run out the door, because I'm just not, it's just not right now." Right? We know that. Marriage is just not that way. A woman doesn't always feel like she's a beautiful flower, does she? She doesn't always feel that way. And he doesn't always treat her that way. You know, the husband doesn't always say to his wife, "You're just the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. I've never seen anything as pretty as you." We don't always do that. That's not reality. And so the Song of Solomon does celebrate these things, but it also gives practical relationship advice. It tells us some things that we need to do to make relationships work. And it talks about real life problems and solutions to marriage issues. So it is romance, but it's real life romance. It talks about, for instance, in chapter 8, the importance of premarital sexual purity. The bride says that she has kept herself sexually pure for her marriage, and that's important. It talks about not rushing into anything. One of the most well-known statements in Song of Solomon is, I urge you, do not awaken love until it pleases. Don't rush anything. Or in chapter 2, the importance of handling problems early. Don't let it get overblown. Don't wait too long to talk to each other to try to solve the problem. And if you need to get on the phone and say to somebody, we're having a lot of problems and we need help. Because what most people do is wait too long. What most people do is wait too long before they deal with problems. Song of Solomon talks about all of these things. Now, before we get any farther into the Song of Solomon, I just want you to notice that those sins that were wiped away this morning, they're still gone. I just want you to see that. They're still gone. They haven't come back, because when God wipes them away, they're always gone. And so I just want you to see that. So they're not back. So, Song of Solomon. We're in chapter 5, verses 2 through 8. Song of Solomon, chapter 5, verses 2 through 8. Remember that there are four main characters in the Song of Solomon. There are other minor characters. There are those who would appear at the end of the show, in the credits at the end. But the four main characters that would appear at the beginning of the show, in the credits, remember, are the bride, the groom, who is Solomon, God, who makes a few appearances and says some things to the couple, and what we usually call the chorus. That is friends of the bride who occasionally, as friends of, women do, kind of chip in and give their view of things and what they think she ought to do, and she asks their advice and that sort of thing. But for our text tonight, it is the bride and the groom. And so we're in chapter 5 and verses 2 through 8, Trouble in Paradise. Chapter 5 and verse 2, the bride is speaking. She says, I was asleep, but my heart was awake. Now, how would you normally take that? I was asleep, but my heart was awake. What would you think that she means by that? Most people probably take it as that she's dreaming. She's sleeping, but her mind is active. Some people take it that she's sort of in that, that wonderful sort of mid, I'm finally getting sleepy and drifting off, and I'm kind of, I'm still there, but I'm not really there, that sort of thing. I think that's probably right. But she is in her bed. She has her own bed chamber. She's in her bed, and she's asleep or getting there. A voice, my beloved, was knocking. So she's done. She's washed her makeup off. Right, she's brushed her hair out 100 times. She's whatever women do to get ready to lotion her elbows and all that sort of stuff. Whatever it is that women do. And she's done all that stuff. She's got her nightgown and she's gotten into bed. She's gotten comfortable. And she's been there long enough to be drifting off to sleep. And she hears her husband at the door. A voice. My beloved was knocking. And so he speaks, open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is drenched with dew, my locks with the damp of night. So while she's been getting ready for bed, Solomon is, I don't know if he's out hunting, I don't know if he's been in some sort of high-level government meeting, I don't know what he's been doing, but he's been off doing something. He's finally gotten off work, and now he wants to come and visit her. And he's been outside for some time because he's drenched with dew. Verse 3, she replies, I've taken off my dress. How can I put it on again? I've washed my feet, How can I dirty them again? We get this. We can totally understand this. She's in bed. She's comfortable. She's in her nightgown. She doesn't have any shoes on. She's drifting off to sleep. And here this big lunkhead comes along yelling at her, knocking on the door. Man, I don't want to get up and fool with this. I don't want to see him right now. I'm going to sleep. But it says, verse 4, my beloved extended his hand through the opening. So I've tried to figure this out. I don't know exactly. I've read about it, and I just don't know what they're saying. But there's some sort of next to the door, there's some sort of an opening, which to me seems to defeat the purpose of a door. If you got a big hole beside it, what's the point of a door? You just reach anyway. So there's some opening, and he reaches his hand in, maybe to open the door, maybe to wave at her. I don't know what he's doing. But he puts his hand in. Well, now, notice her tune is going to change. My beloved extended his hand through the opening, and my feelings were aroused for him. Now, first of all, she don't want nothing to do with him. She wants to go to sleep. But then she seized his lovely hand, come through the opening, and she's like, "Oh, there he is. I think I want to see him after all." So, verse 5, I arose to open to my beloved. Now, apparently, she stops by the, what do y'all call those tables where you put all your perfume and all, like a dressing table. She stops by the dressing table, and she puts on some, as Ray would say, some channel number 5. She puts on some perfume because she wants to greet him smelling nice. Well, that was a mistake because she says, my hands drip with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh. She's gotten herself smelling all nice on the handles of the bowl. I open to my beloved, but what? He's not there. My beloved had gone, turned away. My heart went out to him as he spoke. I searched for him, but I did not find him. So she actually leaves the house, and she's going around looking for him. I called him, but he did not answer me. The watchmen who make the rounds in the city found me. They struck me and wounded me. She's walking around in the middle of the night by herself. And she is found by these watchmen who were supposed to protect people, but they beat her up. The guardsmen of the walls took away my shawl from me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that's the chorus, if you find my beloved, as to what you will tell him, for I am lovesick. I miss him, and I want to give him a big hug and a kiss, but I can't find him. So if you hear from him, please tell him I want to see him. So that's the little vignette there here in chapter 5, verses 2 to 8. So let's break it down and talk about it for a minute and see what we can get out of it. So notice first his request. Solomon is going to do a couple of things that are not easy for a man to do. I think this is key to what happens. Solomon is going to do a couple of things not all that easy for a man to do. First of all, he's really going to open himself up to her and express to her the depth of his feeling. Okay, so guys are it's a little hard for guys to begin with to do that. And if that doesn't go well, if a guy opens himself up and shares his feelings, his innermost feelings, and he gets shut down, he doesn't take that well. Because he didn't really want to do it to start with. But now it's not gone well. The second thing, he's asking for help. Guys are terrible at that. Right? Guys are terrible at that. If you've ever driven around with a man who's lost and won't ask for directions, you know what I'm talking about. But he says, you know, I want to come in, I'm wet, I want to dry off and all clean up and all that stuff. And what happens is she refuses him. She turns him away. That's important. He has opened himself up to her, expressed his feelings, complimented her, and asked her for help, and she completely shut him down. She refuses him. And really, I mean, what do you think about her reasoning? And what do you think about the reason she gives? What does she say? 2 things. I've taken off my dress. I don't want to put it back on. I wash my feet. I don't want to get them dirty. Rhiannon says she's all about it. Rhiannon says she got it right. Leave her alone. It seems a little lame to me. Maybe it isn't. I don't know. But she refuses to let him in. She will not engage with him. Now, I want you to notice something. Turn back to chapter 3. Turn back to chapter 3. The Song of Solomon is more or less chronological. So the earlier in the book, the newer the relationship. The later in the book, the older the relationship. So what happens as a relationship gets older to those initial feelings of, all I want to do is see them, I'll do whatever it takes to see them, and I'll do anything to spend time with. What happens to that? Sometimes that sort of goes away. I want you to notice how she is earlier in the relationship. She says, on my bed, night after night, I sought him. She wanted to be with him, whom my soul loves. I sought him, but did not find him. So she wants him to come to her, but he's not showing up. So look at verse 2. I must arise now and go about the city. In the streets and the squares, I must seek him, whom my soul loves. I sought him, but did not find him. The watchmen who make the rounds in the city found me. I said, have you seen him, whom my soul loves? Scarcely had I left them. When I found him, whom my soul loves, I held on to him and would not let him go until I had brought him to my mother's house and into the room of her who conceived me. I want you to notice how things have changed. First of all, in the earlier account, she's lying on her bed and she wants to see him desperately. She gets tired of waiting, so she does what? She gets up and goes to try to find him. Now, fast forward to later in the relationship. She's lying on her bed. All she wants to do is go to sleep. She doesn't care if he shows up or not. But when he does show up, all he wants her to do is come to the door. And she says what? Not going to do it. Notice how things have changed. When the relationship was younger, when the relationship was newer, she would do anything to spend time with him. Now she's putting him off. When she was emotionally excited about seeing him, when it was something that she really wanted to do, she would go to great lengths to do it. Now that the relationship is older, she's not willing to put out that sort of effort like she was in the past. Now, that's not a knock on her. That goes both ways. But she is the example of it here. And that's something that we've got to be careful about. So, how does he respond? Verses 4 to 6. When she finally does get up and open the door, what has happened? He's gone away. Now, I'm a guy, and I've got some special insight on this, I think. Do you think that when he goes away, he is simply respectfully complying with her, or do you think it's possible that he's pouting? Do you think it's possible that when she says, I'm not getting up, putting on my dress, and getting my feet dirty, he goes, well, fine. And he walks off to punish her. I think that's very likely that that's what's going on. Because guys are good at that. Guys are good at when they don't get things their way to sort of shutting down and pouting and being a little absent. Or maybe it's just me. I don't know. I think this is maybe a thing. And I think that that's probably what he's doing. So now I want you to notice what happens. Look at the results that they experience because of the way that they've handled this situation. He opened up to her, she shut him down. He pouts and goes away, she goes to find him, and so look what happens. It says in verse 6, now they're separated. I mean, not like legally, but they're separated. They're not together. They could have had a time together, but now they don't. Look how she goes out into the city. The watchmen and the guardsmen find her and they wound her. Now, the reason we're told that is because the writer wants to convey the consequences that come when we don't handle the relationship correctly. There are consequences that will happen when we fail to handle the relationship correctly. It can be physical illness, it can be physical harm, it can be stress, it can be all sorts of things. But what the writer is trying to convey is that they did not handle this right, and now everybody is suffering, and it could have been avoided. So just note their previous togetherness, right? When she was willing to let him in and she was seeking for him, they were together. Now they're not together. And they've got this separation and they've got these difficulties between them. That's what happens when we don't handle the relationship correctly. And so what are some ways that we can, in any relationship, prevent or solve relationship problems? Well, let's turn over to another famous passage on love, 1 Corinthians 13. And notice what Paul says there about love. Now, you would think, if you didn't know better, that 1 Corinthians 13 was written for use at weddings. It's about the only time we ever hear it, is a preacher quoting it at a wedding. This was not written for weddings. It was not written for a romantic occasion or for a greeting card. It wasn't written for a date night. 1 Corinthians 13 was written because people were having serious interpersonal problems. People were fighting. People were not getting along. People were having difficulties together. And the answer, according to Paul, as cliched as it sounds, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, all you need is love. But you have to understand what love is. So notice, first of all, in 1 Corinthians 13, 1-3, how Paul talks about the appearance of love. This passage never ceases to amaze me. Look what he says. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. He uses speaking in tongues because that was their particular issue. He says, even if I can perform the most amazing miracles, but I do not love other people, I'm just causing a problem. That's all I'm doing. Verse 2, if I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. Here's the part that amazes me. Verse 3. If I give all my possessions to the poor, to feed the poor rather, and if I surrender my body to be burned, but do not have love, it profits me nothing. I'll be honest with you, I struggle to understand that. It's hard for me to understand how someone could give all of their possessions to feed the poor and not have love. To me, that seems like an ultimate act of love. Or that you could give your body to be burned. How could you do that and not have love? But what the verse proves is that some of the actions that we sometimes point to as proof of love may not be. And this is something a lot of married people need to understand. Some of the actions that we will often point to as proof of love may not be proof of love. What do men say? I go out and work hard. I make a living so that my family can eat. Make sure that my kids have nice clothes and my wife has the things that she needs. I work on the car. Or you get it worked on in my case. But I work on the car. I fix the appliances. I mow the yard. Whatever those things might be. And when a problem arises, the husband will point to those things and say, hey, what are you talking about? Don't question my love. I work hard around here. And the wife can do the same thing. I do the laundry. I cook the meals. I take care of the kids. I clean the house. Don't question my love. Look at what I do. And what Paul says is that there are some things that look like they can be done from love that may not be. I'm not saying they aren't. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying they aren't. I'm saying they may not be. It may be that a husband goes and works hard because he wants to be accomplished and make money and surpass his peers, or show off in front of his neighbors, or be a big shot at home. It could be that a wife works hard at cleaning her house because she just has pride in her stuff and wants to show off her house. I'm not saying that's necessarily the case. Please don't misunderstand me. What I'm saying is that it's not enough to just point to what you do and say, that proves that I love you. Particularly when you're not doing the things he talks about in verses 4 to 6. Look at verse 4. Love is patient. Love is kind and is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant. Love does not act unbecomingly. It does not seek its own. It's not provoked. It does not take into account a wrong suffered. It does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but with the truth. Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. You see what he says? Just notice a couple of the things that he says. He talks about patience, being patient with each other, not being provoked, not getting angry quickly, not going from 0 to 60 over some small thing that your spouse did, not getting ticked off at every little thing that happens, not raising your volume and using sarcasm and using insults, bringing up things from the past. You see, you can go to work and work hard and provide for your family and then come home and yell at everybody. And they say, well, why are you yelling at everybody? Well, don't question me. I work hard for this family. Sure, but you also come home and yell at it. You don't have any patience. Everything provokes you. That's not love. That isn't love. He talks about kindness, treating other people with kindness, doing nice things for people, being considerate of their feelings. He talks about love, not seeking its own, not being selfish, not only looking after oneself. So you can fix all the cars and buy all the appliances and pay for all the college educations and clean all the rooms and cook all the meals and change all the diapers. You can do all of those things. And they're not necessarily a proof of love. When you lack patience, when you lack kindness, when you lack selflessness, they may not necessarily be the proofs of love that we think we are. And so what he talks about then in verse 7 is the attitudes that we need to have. So look what these attitudes are, and then we'll finish up. Verse 7. First of all, he talks about perseverance. What does love put up with in verse 7? All things. Love bears all things. Love doesn't draw a line and say, that's it. I'm not putting up with that. I'm not going any farther than that. I'm not tolerating you anymore because of that. Now, is that an absolute statement? People ask me a disturbing amount of times. I get asked the question, what should a woman do who's being abused at home? If the Bible says there's only one cause for divorce, what should a woman do who's being abused at home? Shockingly, when doing some research on that one time, I ran across a website run by a gentleman who is anonymous. He won't tell you who he is, who says that it's a woman's obligation to live with a man even if he is physically abusive, that a woman has no right to leave that situation. And I think that's beyond ludicrous. I think that's crazy. I've told my daughter a million times, and I tell every woman I know in an abusive situation, they need to get out and never go back, because that's probably not going to change. So are there, yes, there are things that are too far. Abuse is too far. infidelity, the spouse may decide, is too far. But the normal things that husbands and wives have to deal with in marriage, the spouse is not allowed to draw the line and say, I'm just not going to put up with that. This says love bears all things. And then it says that love believes all things. It's just a statement of trust. It's not a statement of gullibility. It's not a statement of being stupid and saying all the evidence points to this, but I'm not going to believe that. I'm going to have blind faith. That's not a good practice. But spouses should trust one another. And then he says that spouses should be optimistic in verse 7. Love hopes all things. Love is optimistic. Love believes that even though the spouse is struggling with this thing or that thing, it can get better. We can work on it and we can try to get better and improvements can be made. But here's the remarkable thing to me. What's the last thing he says? The last thing he says is that love endures all things. And I've spent many years trying to figure out the difference between the first thing he says, bearing all things, and the last thing he says, enduring all things. And you know the conclusion I came to? There is no difference between them. He talks about perseverance twice. And I think that's amazing. Is there anything that we need more in a successful marriage than perseverance? Than just getting up day after day and sometimes putting up with the same old stuff and sometimes dealing with the same issues, the same challenges, same hardships, day after day, when it's as hard as it can be. Paul says that true love, he says it twice, true love perseveres. It gets up and does it again tomorrow. That's what love does, and that's what marriage needs. Well, after the last lesson on Song of Solomon, Neil got up and said a few comments about the sermon and said, you know, I think we could use some more of some lessons on Song of Solomon, so I always try to obey my elders. And that's what we're going to do. And so, Lord willing, it won't be every month, but every several weeks, we'll come back and revisit the Song of Solomon and talk about various passages and principles from the Song of Solomon. Next time, Lord willing, in a few weeks, chapter 1:15 through chapter 2 and verse 2. Just a reminder, on Wednesday night, we're going to begin I'm really excited about this class, a class on apologetics. We will talk about defending our faith, knowing why we believe. All right, we spend so much time, rightfully, talking about what we believe. We're going to talk on Wednesday nights about why we believe it. So important. And I hope you'll be here for that. It's going to be great. So, Ray, our song again was what?
877.
877. So go ahead and turn to that song, and we'll sing it in just a minute. Number 877. We'll sing that song in just a sec. So what we've been talking about tonight is a very narrow topic. And at this point, for a lot of you, something that doesn't directly apply. One thing that we talked about before, though, I hope that you'll keep in mind, if you're single, if you're not married, you're not going to be married, whatever your situation, we still need to know the truth. The biblical truth about marriage, we still need to support that. We still need to stand for that. Whatever your marital situation, we all need to understand the truth about marriage, and Song of Solomon can help us to do that. So I hope that it's been helpful to you in some way. But what we've talked about is very narrow. But tonight, whatever your situation, married, unmarried, whatever, if there's something in your relationship with God that needs to be addressed, if there's something in your relationship with God that needs to be fixed or dealt with or improved, this is a great opportunity for you to get help with that. It may be something you can just take care of by yourself. It may be something that you want to get with one of us privately and we can talk together sometime after our services. Or you might want to come forward and take a seat on the front as we stand and sing.